Hello and welcome to the Martian Drive-In Podcast 115. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around I'm doing one recent movie and one somewhat older movie. The first one, the older movie, is from 1970, and it's Equinox, which was directed and produced and created by Oscar-winning special effects guy Dennis Muren. Then we move on to 2009 for a bit of Apocalypso, starring Nicolas Cage, and it is Alex Proyas' science fiction Apocalypse Knowing, also starring Rose Byrne and a few interesting Australian character actors. So sit back, I will get the contact details out of the way on this rainy Sunday afternoon, and we'll get the show started.
The Martian Drive-In Podcast appears every 2 weeks. It's a podcast of science fiction, horror and fantasy movie appreciation, and sometimes television. It doesn't matter if it's old or new, good or bad, black or white or colour. As long as I like it, it may show up here. There are also occasional roundtables where I get together a group of like-minded people and we discuss a particular topic of interest to genre film nerds. You can support the podcast by donating at patreon.com/paleocinema. You can keep up with podcast news at the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. You can leave reviews on iTunes and send MP3 or written feedback to cultguru@gmail.com. That's cult with a K. This podcast may contain adult discussions, so don't listen to it in the car while driving the kids to school.
Previously on Martian Drive-In Podcast, I was talking about the possibility that I would be made redundant from my job, and lo and behold, it has occurred. Technically, I'm supposed to finish on the 2nd of August, and they're giving me some go-away money, but I'm kind of angling to get that sooner. I really want to kind of move on with things, and it's a bit dull going to work when you know that you're not going to be there very long. So I've asked them to let me go earlier, and I've taken a week off of my sick leave to use up my sick leave, and also because I needed to get my head straight on a couple of things. So it's been very interesting times, lots of change in my life, lots of change in my world, but not necessarily a bad thing. We've also bought a few things for around the place. We've got some theatre seating for the viewing area, the main one where I watch movies and television. So we've got a couple of reclining armchairs linked together, kind of cinema, posh cinema seating style. And there are little cup holders with lights in them, and the seats recline electronically. It's all very high tech and wonderful. So we invested in a couple of those. And I've got on a back order, which I get early next month, or early August, a 55-inch 4K TV screen. So the quality of the viewing is going to be improved enormously next month when the big TV comes in. Of course, to house the big TV, I've had to get a new IKEA TV unit to put the damn thing in. So the old one's gone out. We've assembled the IKEA successfully with a minimum of conniptions as a two-person job. And thank you very much to Sally for helping me out with that and doing some of the heavy lifting on it. Basically it's lots of moving around and doing stuff. We got a new lounge suite for the other room as well, and a few other bits and pieces, but been kind of busy but good. I've kind of worked out that I want some downtime, so I'm going to be taking some downtime. We're going up to Sydney again in August to actually for a weekend. We're going to be kid wrangling my 7-year-old nephew Billy while his parents take a well-earned break up in the Hunter Valley. So we're going to go over to my sister's place and hang out with the nephew for a while and test out the new car on the long country roads. Why didn't nobody tell me that cruise control was so good? The previous car didn't have cruise control, but the new RAV4 does. And cruise control's great. All you've got to do is steer. It's like playing a fucking computer game. Fantastic. I am in love with cruise control. I really like it. I think it's one of the better inventions since sliced bread. And it feels weird when you first use it. When you first go to use cruise control on a car, it feels like you're doing something wrong when you're actually not. But I'm in love with cruise control, and it's going to make the 890-kilometre drive up to Sydney a hell of a lot easier. And a lot better on the ankles, because previously you had to keep your foot on the accelerator for, which changed drivers, but it's still a fairly long shift, and eventually your foot gets sore. And I've got very large feet, so the leverage between ankle and shin means that my feet do have an effect from being constantly on an accelerator, and it can cramp things up a bit. But yeah, I love cruise control. I love the new cinema seating. If you go to my Facebook page, you can see a picture of it. And I anticipate loving the big 55-inch 4K TV screen that I'm getting from Kogan early next month. So yeah, lots of changes, and I'm looking at the positive side of things. It's a little bit scary not having the safety net of a regular job, but we'll work it through. We've got possibilities. We've cleared our debts. Everything's going to be fine there, and it gives me a lot more time to concentrate on things like improving podcast quality, which is one of the big things I want to do, and also writing a lot more essays about film. I'm kind of still on my training wheels as far as that's concerned, but I anticipate doing much, much better at it in the near future. And if you go to the Patreon page, patreon.com/paleocinema, you can see my first efforts in that regard. So yeah, interesting times. Shit, it looks bad outside. It's raining, it's cloudy, and the wind has blown cardboard boxes from all of the things we've purchased all around the backyard. We've got them stored around there until we can get rid of them. But the wind has grabbed them and moved them to unlikely places in the backyard. So that looks a bit miserable and weird, but we'll get there. Anyway, what have I been watching? Well, a few things. A lot of YouTube videos, of course, because that's my chewing gum at the moment. Let me have a look at the Letterboxd. I did watch John Wick 2, Electric Boogaloo, the second of the Keanu Reeves shoots everybody and kills everyone action flicks. It's got Ian McShane back and a good supporting cast, people like Lance Reddick again, and Franco Nero's in there as well, which is kind of cool. And apparently it's part of a trilogy, and it sets up the third part of the trilogy quite well. Not as good as the first one, the dog doesn't get killed, but it's kind of fun, and it's more of the same in a sense. Second films in trilogies are always kind of a weird place as far as the energy and the arc of a movie series is concerned. Nonetheless, it's worth checking out because you're going to want to see number three, which is kind of cool. And the universe that evolved from the first John Wick and into this one is increasingly interesting. It's kind of like The Purge with rules. If you're into that kind of thing, it's worth checking out. A few people have asked me whether it's worth seeing, and yeah, seen the first one, see the second one, invest a couple of hours. It's not going to piss you off particularly. Again, it's not as surprising as the first one because we know pretty much what to expect with the second one. Nonetheless, I'm looking forward to the third one. So for the radio gig, the ABC Local Radio Northern Territory gig that I do with the wonderful Rebecca McLaren, who also wants to see John Wick 2, by the way, we did a little bit of a weird thing. We talked a bit about female Doctor Who's and the controversy regarding that. As a part of that, we watched Doctor Who and the Daleks, the Amicus made 1965, not quite canon, Doctor Who movie. And we talked a little bit about that, but mostly we talked about female Doctor Who's and how we were both okay with it and were on board with it. A lot of people disagree, and a lot of people don't like us, don't like their childhood messed with for some reason, as if it's going to affect the way you were as a child. It's not messing with your childhood. Your childhood is still there. Your childhood is still what it was. It's messing with things you knew from your childhood. And get used to it, because change and time are going to do that. There's nothing you can do about it. Enjoy the stuff as it was, if that's your kind of thing, but allow things to change, because you're only going to upset yourself, and you're going to have to lay down and take an aspirin and put a soft, wet cloth on your forehead once all of this shit settles. And a year from now, you'll be okay with it. But there is a lot of fuss about that, so we talked about that a little bit. We also talked about the deaths of Martin Landau and George Romero, and gave full kudos to them. I talked a few things I liked Landau in, particularly Woody Allen's Crimes and Misdemeanors, where his character of Jude is one of the great unsung monsters of cinema, in a sense. So we grooved on that, and we talked about Romero and how he reinvented zombies, and how zombies weren't the ubiquitous rampaging hordes of monsters that we knew until George Romero came along. They were individuals who were cursed or in some way affected by other people and who became zombies. They weren't crazy, endless seas of dead people. that we now come to expect from that genre, and it's all because of George Romero. So all credit to George, and both him and Martin Landau will be missed. So we had a good time with that. It was a little bit different from our usual format where we talk about one movie for half an hour, but we both enjoyed it. Beck wasn't feeling particularly well, but she says it all kind of came out well. She spliced in a bit of audio from various things we spoke about in post-production, and they're happy with it. So I'm happy with it too. Not sure what we're doing next time. We were going to talk about Spider-Man Homecoming, but the time may have passed for that. But nonetheless, I'm still enjoying the radio gig. It's a lot of fun, and I'll continue doing it even though I won't be in the city on those Thursdays anymore. I'll make the special trip in to talk about movies for the worldwide audience on the internet, and more specifically the people in the Northern Territory, because I enjoy it. They want me to keep doing it, and I'm supporting the national broadcaster by doing so. So that actually is one of the greatest things about doing that gig, apart from the fact that you get to go into ABC studios and you see famous people a lot. The other good thing about it is you're contributing to national culture in a tiny, ridiculous way. And I really love being a part of that. I love supporting the ABC. It's threatened by various conservative and neoliberal people who wanted to have advertising and want the government to defund it and all sorts of shit like that. Nonetheless, being a part of the ABC in a small way is an honour. For me, it's an opportunity that not a lot of people get. And I really don't underestimate how it's a lovely thing for me in my life and for the way I see myself. And just talking to some of the most wonderful people I've ever worked with in any context, and just being a tiny bit of the national culture in a way is something that you don't expect when you left school at 15 and started working in factories and did all of the things that I've had in my past. It's not something that I expected to be doing at this time of my life, but it's something that I really do enjoy, and I'm really, again, as I said, I feel honored by. I also did a bit of a rewatch on some old, later era Alfred Hitchcock, and I'm about a third of the way through watching Hitchcock's Frenzy from about 1970, which stars John Finch, Barry Foster, and Anna Massey. And yeah, I kind of like it. It's very much showing Hitchcock as an old man. And I think it's Hitchcock being nostalgic for the London he knew before he left in about 1930 to travel to Hollywood, and not really representative of 40 years later. Nonetheless, it does show a lot of his conceits and a lot of his fun. And it's still Hitchcock, which means it's still entertaining at the very least. So I'm looking forward to finishing that one. I haven't quite yet because other things interrupted me. Now let me just get the letterboxed back up so I can look at the rest of it. There's a thing on Netflix that I saw, a very small budget post-apocalyptic zombie movie with a very small cast. It's called Here Alone, and I kind of recommend it because it's got some chops to it. The main character is a woman called Anna, who's living in the woods, avoiding the zombies, played by an actor called Lucy Walters, who's very good at it. And she's living by herself and kind of surviving by making little raids to a country house and then back again before the zombies can come out. And it's quite transgressive, it's quite bleak and nasty, and it shows, it's got a kind of verisimilitude about it. It's got a sense of realism that even things like The Walking Dead don't have. Again, it's a small budget by a small group of people who didn't want to go into the studio system to make the stories they wanted to tell. The director is someone called Rod Blackhurst, and it may be worth just keeping an eye on him and just seeing what he comes up with in the future, because he does have some chops. And even though this was done on a fairly small budget with a fairly small cast of actors, I think that there's something there that should be nurtured. So Here Alone is definitely one for the zombie fans, and it's also some nice bits of acting in it, and it also thinks through some of the concepts with the zombie apocalypse, which are quite interesting, and at times, as the movie plays out, heartbreaking. Now, the only other thing I've been watching, which is of interest to me at least, is there's a whole bunch of movie trailers for upcoming tentpole movies that have dropped because of Comic-Con. And I saw the Thor and Ragnarok trailer. I saw Guillermo del Toro's latest effort, which is kind of a romantic version of The Creature from the Black Lagoon called The Shape of Water. So I'm looking forward to that one as well. And there are, of course, there's a Justice League trailer. The jury's still out on Justice League, though I think they have lightened up a lot from the Zack Snyder influence. And having said that, I'll go and see the movie anyway. It's got Gal Gadot in it. And there's some possibilities there, but we'll see how we go with it. I'm prepared to be disappointed, but I'm also prepared to be delighted. So all of that kind of stuff's rolling out here while it's summertime up north and it's fucking miserable down in Melbourne town. So I'm going to take a break, and when I get back, we're going to be talking about a movie made for $6,500 in 1967. The movie rights were sold by the original creator, Dennis Muren, and the movie was extended somewhat and released in 1970 as Equinox.
What happened to Dr. Waterman? Only this man, last to see him alive, knows. Equinox, the invisible barrier between good and evil. The invisible barrier between light and the forces of darkness. The supernatural before your very eyes as four teenage boys and girls fight a devil cult for their sanity, for their lives, for their eternal souls. Equinox, a story that defies logic, confounds belief.
I can't believe it. It was just a fall.
What is the secret of the thousand-year-old book? What are the unspeakable horrors conjured by the forces of evil? What is the fiendish power of the ring that enslaves and destroys? What is the one symbol that can hold at bay the hosts of hell unleashed on earth? Equinox! Proving again that there is more in heaven and on earth than is dreamt of in our philosophy. Equinox! Equinox! Begins where Rosemary's Baby left off.
No, actually, it doesn't begin where Rosemary's Baby left off, so just ignore that bit of unusually weird hyperbole. But the movie is good in itself. It's one of those movies that harks back to the days of Famous Monsters of Filmland magazine that Forry Ackerman edited and created back in the late 1950s. It's very much got that kind of feel to it. As I said, the movie was incredibly low budget. $6,500 budget. And all of the money is up there on the screen. The plot's fairly simple. There are four teenagers who have a picnic in the canyons of California. They stumble upon an ancient book when they go into Bronson Canyon Caves, which contains the secret. I'm reading this off Wikipedia, so excuse me. An ancient book containing secrets of a strange world that exists alongside our own. They consequently unleash a plethora of evil creatures and monsters. Well, it's not a plethora. There's only about two. But nonetheless, it's interesting stuff. The movie was originally made in 1967 by Dennis Muren, a guy who went on to win an Oscar, so it's definitely got credibility. And in fact, the movie is so well regarded that it has had a Criterion release. Now, the version that I've got isn't the Criterion release. It's the Umbrella Entertainment release from here in Australia. But it does have a couple of extras, including some cast interviews and just enough of the good stuff to really flesh out what we know about the movie. Now, Dennis Muren went on to do visual effects stuff and won a whole bunch of Oscars. 1980, he won it for something I don't really recall, called Star Wars Episode V, The Empire Strikes Back. Again for E.T., Return of the Jedi, Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, Inner Space, The Abyss, Terminator 2, Judgment Day, and Jurassic Park. So not too bad a deal there. Dennis Muren started out with wind-up. In fact, this movie was made with a wind-up Bolex camera, which basically was a camera that ran 16mm and you wound it up and you could only run it for a short time before it wound down. The mechanism in the camera kept the camera, the film speed constant, but when it ran down, so you won't see any really long takes in this particular movie, as indeed you do in Knowing, the other film I'm going to talk about in the podcast. But the cast are kind of people that are now forgotten in the industry, but it doesn't really matter because the important thing about this film is the audacity of it. In 1970, Muren sold the rights to the movie to a producer of B and C grade movies, a guy called Jack H. Harris, who actually died this year, oddly enough. He was 98 when he died. He died in March this year. But he was a producer on a few films that may be of interest to you. The Blob, The 4D Man, which I did in a very early Martian Drive-In podcast, a movie starring Robert Lansing, who was considered for the lead in this film, but they couldn't arrange it. Dinosaurus, he was also the producer on. Equinox, of course, Beware the Blob, the sequel to The Blob. Schlock, the John Landis movie Schlock. Dark Star, and a couple of other things, including, oddly enough, The Eyes of Laura Mars, starring Faye Dunaway. So he did have a bit of a track record there of as a producer. And so he got the rights to Muren's film, decided the running time was a bit short, got the actors back in, did a bit more filming to flesh it out, and the end result was The Equinox, that was released theatrically in 1970. And I kind of like this film. It harks back to the kinds of films I saw as a child, and I don't believe I did see this one as a child. I may have seen it in my teens somewhere. They tend to blur a little bit after the 300th or 400th movie you see in the cinemas when you're a teenager, but there's no nudity in it, nothing shocking. The odd thing about it is that it was released in 1970 theatrically, and it goes to show the difference in the way teenagers and young people dressed between 1967 and 1970, because it looks like a mid-1960s movie. You've got the guys in sports shirts and the girls in capri pants with their hair up. It really shows that between 67 and 70, the whole hippie thing and the youth culture changed enormously. And as a part of that, by the time it was released theatrically, I'm sure it looked dated to the people seeing it in the cinemas at the time. It's just one of those times when fashion and taste evolved at a very rapid rate, and it shows very much in this movie. Take a look at something. I'll give you a comparison. Take a look at, say, a beach party movie with Frankie Avalon and Annette Funicello from about 1965, and then compare it to any youth movie of any sort that wasn't done by old men in 1970, and you'll see that kind of transition happening there. That's just a side issue, but it's kind of interesting. Now, Muren and his team did a whole bunch of interesting things. There's some stop-motion animation, including an enormous Cthulhu-esque monster that smashes a country cabin. Again, that's stop-motion animation, so it's not going to be anywhere near as good as something you'll see in a modern film. But I like the fact that he did it, and I like the fact that he's got this tentacle monster with a big eye. It looks a bit like Cthulhu's head has smashed a country cabin, which is kind of cool. There's also a red flying demon, which again, slightly ropey CG. It's not up near Harryhausen's level, but it's still quite good. And there's also some forced perspective work with a giant, a green giant, oddly enough. It may be a pun on the Jolly Green Giant, but they did this one interestingly because forced perspective means you've got one actor in the foreground and one actor off to one side of them in the mid-background. And you set the camera up in such a way that it looks like they're standing in front next to each other. And so one of them looks enormously larger than the other. And the way they did this was kind of interesting because what they did was they had the guy playing the giant, an actor called Jim Duron, standing on a picnic table in the foreground. And what they did was the surface of the picnic table was covered in dirt and little plants and rocks and things to match the background. So you can see, if it's brought to your attention, you can see that he's actually standing on a table. But they've really well matched the dirt and stuff they have on the tabletop with the background. So the forced perspective works surprisingly well. It's not perfect, but it works better than you would expect for a $6,500 movie to have in it. And I kind of like that. And the fact that I can see the slight outline of the table just a little bit when I was watching the movie made the movie better. It didn't take away this, but the fact that the special effects were, when you knew about them, visible, didn't take away. It enhanced the movie for me. Just seeing how they had a challenge, how to make a giant and a normal-sized human being in the same frame, and they met the challenge. And I really admire them for that. Now, the movie structure is kind of interesting too, because there's a frame story around it. I don't know whether this was the part that Jack Harris did to flesh out the story at all, but it may well have been, in fact, but I'm not too sure. Frame story is that one of the teenagers escapes from the countryside. A guy called, a character called David Fielding, played by Edward Connell. He escapes and he's run over by a car which doesn't have a driver. And some people find him and take him to hospital. And because he's got this tremendous story about monsters and arcane books and how his friends have died and disappeared and all this kind of stuff, they put him in a lunatic asylum, basically. And at the end of the movie, we find out that one of the reasons why he's scared and almost catatonic and clutching on to a crucifix for the entire year he's in the mental hospital is the fact that at the end of the events that lead up to him getting run over by the car, the demon has told him that in a year and a day, he will be killed by the demon. And he's clutching onto that. And then at the end of the movie, we see the rest of the frame and find out what the events that are going to kill him are. Now, that's not too much of a spoiler. It's an old movie. It's a B-movie. Just bear with the spoilers. By the way, the full movie is on YouTube, but if you're really committed to this kind of film, you will find a permanent and paid copy of it. They're around, and they're not hard to find. Umbrella Entertainment here in Australia will sell you one for pocket change, really. Well, there are a few other little aspects of the film that I like. The fact that the assistant cameraman on the film was the son of a famous actor, a guy called Ed Begley. So Ed Begley Jr. was the assistant cameraman on Dennis Muren's original film. Took him 2.5 years to make the original film for $6,500, which parallels a more recent thing. The Australian movie Wormwood was made on weekends over a couple of years. So that tradition of getting together when you've got the bucks to continue making your film definitely happens. And it's still happening. And there are people that are doing these things. They've got a story they want to tell. They can't get the big boys to finance it or be part of it. And so they do it when they can with what they have. And I kind of like that ingenuity and that persistence in making these films, even though they're not going to be as polished and well looked after as a much bigger budget movie. People are giving up their spare time to make these films, and I kind of like that. Now, the Bronson Canyons was done without permission. I'm just reading through a few notes here on IMDb. The exterior shots they did on the cave at Bronson Canyon were shot without permission, and the interior of the caves were actually a set built in Dennis Muren's backyard. And the old man they meet in the cave who gives them the book, which it may or may not be the Necronomicon. It's not named as such, but it acts pretty much as the same as a Necronomicon in more traditional H.P. Lovecraftian Cthulhu mythology. The old guy who gives them the book is actually Dennis Muren's grandfather, which was kind of cool as well. There are a few other little bits that are interesting. The lead actor's sideburns vary depending on when they made the movie, because, of course, this is made at a time when sideburns got longer. And the other bit that I really, really like is the fact that one of my favourite classic era science fiction and fantasy writers plays a role as Professor Waterman in this movie, and that is Fritz Leiber Jr. Now, there's a lot of confusion in people between Fritz Leiber Sr., his father, who was a Shakespearean actor, and Fritz Leiber Jr. Fritz Leiber Sr. appeared in a whole bunch of different movies in the 1930s and 1940s. But Jr. was better known as a writer. In fact, I've talked previously on a Martian Drive-In podcast about Burn Witch Burn, the 1962 movie starring Peter Wingard, also known as Night of the Eagle. That was based on a Fritz Leiber story called Conjure Wife. And in fact, there have been a number of different adaptations of that. You've got to find some of Leiber's work. The science fiction stuff is really interesting. He won a couple of Hugo Awards for his work. But the things that he's known for that are most popular are a whole bunch of fantasy stories about two characters called Fafhrd and the Grey Mouser, who are an enormous Norseman kind of character, and his small, cunning, thief-like companion. Really interesting stories. They were adapted as comics as well. You should be able to find them without too much trouble. But finding copies of the Fritz Leiber, Fafhrd and Grey Mouser stories, they're great, they're entertaining, they're fun, they're evocative, they're beautifully written, and they have a lot of humour in them as well. And he was the guy who really brought that kind of touch of lightness to the fantasy genre in his writing. And he turns up as a professor. Doesn't get a lot of dialogue. In the original short film that Dennis Muren did, apparently Fritz Leiber got a lot more dialogue than he did in the theatrical cut that Jack Harris put together. But it was good to see him in here, and it's the only real opportunity in an easily accessible way to see him as an actor. He only did a couple of other things. He wasn't in that, because IMDb's got him and his father mixed up, which is not an uncommon thing. He's got four IMDb actor credits, and two of those are for his father, which is kind of a bit ropey. Equinox is one of his theatrical credits, and a documentary called The Bermuda Triangle from 1979. He's in that as well, briefly playing a Hispanic character for some reason. But it was good to see him in there, and the fact that Fritz Leiber was a part of it goes to show that he was supportive of Dennis Muren's efforts. And it is an opportunity to see one of the kind of grandfathers and one of the grandmasters of science fiction in a fairly low budget but nonetheless easily accessible horror movie. And the horror in this one is kind of not Texas Chainsaw Massacre of Night of the Living Dead or even kind of the Souls horror. It's more kind of icky in a sense. There's a demon in the form of a park ranger called Asmodeus, played by Jack Woods, who directed the movie, who's quite creepy in various parts, and basically tries to hypnotize the teenagers. He's kind of interesting too, because the thing I noticed about him that I really liked and was appalled by at the same time was Jack Woods is basically trying to channel Sterling Hayden in playing this character called Asmodeus, who pretends to be a park ranger but is actually a red-winged demon in human disguise. And if you watch Equinox and just remember that Asmodeus is supposed to be Sterling Hayden, the famous character actor, it's kind of interesting to watch it from that point of view, and it gives you a slightly different perspective on the character as well. And you wonder what it would have been like had Sterling Hayden actually done the role, which he didn't do because he was basically smoking marijuana in Malibu at the time. But nonetheless, Equinox, in fact, I'm remembering I did see this on late night television on Channel 10 back in the early 1970s, and thought it was kind of cool. It would have been in black and white in those days in Australian television. But there were a whole bunch of these cheap B, C, D, E, and low grade science fiction movies that were put on late at night on commercial television. Sometimes overnight, there were movie marathons overnight. I miss movie marathons. There were these things where and I'll explain this in the context of my own life, where all night they would run about four horror and science fiction movies from the 1950s and early 1960s all night on Saturday nights, occasionally on Channel 10 in Sydney. And one of the things as a child that I really wanted to do was stay up and watch an all-night movie. And one night my father passed out drunk, so my little brother Gary and I stayed up all night watching these horror movies on the television with the sound turned down a bit. And the weird thing was, we were kids. We were like, I was, might have been 10 or 12 at the time. I thought you get five or six movies in between midnight and dawn. And it turns out that after the fourth movie, we realized that the sun was coming up and that everybody in the household would wake up soon. And we were shitting ourselves because we were worried that they would find out that we'd been up all night watching these horror movies. So we turned the TV off and went to bed and kind of pled sick to get a little bit of sleep in the morning. And nobody in the household ever found out that we'd actually stayed up all night. But we were under the misapprehension that you'd probably get six movies between midnight and dawn. We didn't crunch our numbers correctly on that one. So we watched the four movies and felt very naughty for doing that. And I think that's one of the things with genre films as a child. It's much, much nicer if you sneak them rather than have permission to see them. See the things your parents don't want you to see. I recommend that to any child listening, and fuck knows why they'd be listening to my podcast. But if there's a child out there by some weird coincidence listening to this podcast, see the movies your parents don't want you to see. I'm not saying look at hardcore pornography because it's only going to confuse you. What I'm saying is see the horror movies and see the science fiction movies and see the genre films and even see some quality cinema that your parents don't think you're quite ready for. Sometimes you won't be. Sometimes you'll come away with more questions than you have answered. But it's the way you expand your knowledge and your passion for cinema is to step outside your comfort zone, even if you're a kid. So for us, it was watching horror movies late at night on television, things like The Hypnotic Eye and Monster of the Piedras Blancas and things like that. Those were the ones that really did expand my love of genre cinema. So not too much else to say about Equinox. It's worth having in your collection. It's worth watching. Probably with a few people. Sit around. It's one of those popcorn movies where you can sit around and enjoy it with a few people and point out the ropey special effects and the fact that the demon, when it's descending from the sky, is on two bits of wire. And all of those kind of fun things. And just enjoy it for what it is. A noble effort, $6,500, done by somebody who had a passion for special effects and wanted to make a movie. And he got people together. The actors were paid bugger all, but they would then have a movie that they were in so they could go to agencies and say, yes, I've been in the movie. Here it is. This is the movie I've been in. They did it basically for that reason. And all strength of them for that. People are still doing that to this day. In fact, Claire McKenna, a friend of mine who was on the podcast a while back, made her own movie in exactly that way, a movie called Liminal, which I was honoured enough to have a copy of, but has never been released anywhere for any length of time in any way, really. But she made it in her garage. She made it on the beach. She made it in all sorts of different places, and it was a passion project for her. And got friends involved. In fact, one of my best friends is in the movie. But anyway, I'm going to wind it up there for Equinox. And just on a note of respect and honouring guerrilla filmmaking on a very, very low budget. And that it can lead to some interesting outcomes, particularly for someone like Dennis Muren, who's got a passion for it and who followed it through in his career and got the breaks that he needed to become very influential in the special effects world. And so I'll take the break, and when I get back, we're going to talk about a movie which is very mixed for me, 2009's Knowing, starring Nicolas Cage, Rose Byrne, and The Apocalypse.
You and me together forever.
50 years ago, the students of William Dawes Elementary imagined what the future might hold. today, we unveiled their legacy.
It's a list of dates.
Every major global disaster for the last 50 years in perfect sequence. The next number on the chain predicts that tomorrow, 81 people are going to die in some kind of tragedy.
Get off the train.
Why? What's wrong?
Just take the baby and get off the train.
Estimates put the presumed dead at 81.
The prediction came true. It's not coincidence. Don't let him watch the news.
Why won't you tell me what's going on? They were here.
Who?
The Whisperer people.
The numbers are a warning. They're a warning to everyone.
This is not a test. This is an emergency broadcast transmission.
Are we gonna die?
I will never let that happen, Caleb. Do you hear me? Never.
Knowing it's a film I feel conflicted about, not the least because Alex Proyas, the director, blocked me on Facebook. But leaving that aside, Proyas has done some good stuff, Dark City. Even like his Gods of Egypt, which is a fucking crazy movie. But this one I like for a couple of reasons, one of which is some of it was filmed not 3 kilometres from here. The big scene with Rose Byrne getting hit by a truck was filmed basically 3 streets away from here. And the enormous set piece of an aircraft accident, which appears in the film, was filmed down on the Geelong Bypass Road, which isn't that far away from here. Most of the rest of the film was also filmed in various parts of Melbourne. So we always get a little tingle from the thought that movie making isn't something that happens on the other side of the ocean. It's something that can happen almost literally in your own backyard. But having said that, the movie is kind of interesting. It starts out in 1959 at the opening of a school where children are asked to contribute to a time capsule that will be buried for 50 years. Lots of kids draw pictures of what they think that the future of 50 years is going to be like. But one little girl, Lucinda Embry, does a whole bunch of seemingly random numbers in a row on her sheet of paper. And that reluctantly is included in the time capsule. We move forward 50 years and Nicolas Cage's character, John Kessler, is a scientist working for MIT in America. He's got a mate who's a cosmologist, and the mate's played by Ben Mendelsohn, who apparently was in a recent Star Wars movie but has a long, good career as a character actor here in Australia way back into his very early years. The Kessler character has a son who has a hearing problem. It's not deafness, but he has trouble kind of identifying words, and a hearing aid helps him with that. And the son is at the school when the time capsule is revealed. And he gets the envelope, which has the random numbers in it, rather than a cool 50-year-old picture of rocket ships and jetpacks. And so the son, whose name is Caleb, brings the paperwork home, and because his father's a scientist and sees patterns in things, he comes to the realization that this 50-year-old sheet of paper predicts the time, well, the date and the amount of deaths in all of the major disasters over the last 50 years, and also the coordinates, the latitude and longitude of those particular disasters. I'm not sure how they worked it out for the tsunami, because that covered most of Southeast Asia. But leaving aside that kind of stuff, Kessler finds out that this piece of paper basically predicted the future, and that challenges his atheism and his idea that the universe is a randomly happening, ongoing series of events. He finds out that somebody in some way is able to predict the future, and he finds this profoundly troubling. He's not able to meet the young girl who wrote the original numbers because she died a few years ago, but he is able to meet her daughter, played by Australian actor Rose Byrne, and the granddaughter, who is the same age as Caleb. And so as things move along, he goes to the cabin where Lucinda Embry spent the last years of her life, and finds out that she was, like himself, fascinated with disasters and knew, you know, basically kept track of what was happening on that paperwork that she was generating in her childhood. Meanwhile, his mate, played by Ben Mendelsohn, is telling him that people see patterns in numbers that aren't necessarily there, and tries to convince him that the patterns that he's recognizing are just random events that he's putting a pattern on. He eventually comes around to the belief, along with Kessler, played by Nicolas Cage, that indeed somebody was able to predict these events. And that then, of course, challenges their worldview in a very profound way. Now, here's where we get into spoiler territory for the movie, which is partly revealed in the trailer, but not entirely. So if you haven't seen the film and you care about that kind of thing, you might want to jump forward a little bit. But they find out that the numbers predict the end of the world. And as the movie progresses, we find out that's going to be through a mass coronal ejection from the sun, which is basically an enormous sunspot blasting a whole bunch of particles and matter out of the sun directly at the Earth. And anything not more than a mile underground is going to be blasted by this and die. So this piece of paper from 1959 has predicted the end of life as we know it. Meanwhile, the children are being stalked by men who telepathically whisper to them and tell them things. We see things from the adult's viewpoint, so we don't actually know until well late in the movie exactly what they're whispering to these two children. But we have the sense of them being ominous figures. And they kind of bear a little bit of a resemblance to the Slender Man and Men in Black and all those other urban myths about creepy people who know the basic structure of the world in a way that we don't. So up to a point, the movie is really good. There is a scene with a traffic jam in the rain where Nicolas Cage's character gets out of the car and kind of walks towards the police who are manning a roadblock near a car accident, while a plane crashes across the highway and into the field next door. And there is a really bravura scene there, where in one take we see Nicolas Cage being aware of the plane crash happening, the plane crashing into the field, and Cage's character running into the wreckage and seeing people on fire coming out of the plane and trying to help people who have survived the crash. And it really is a masterful piece of disaster filmmaking. And all credit to Prose for that. Using a combination of CG and practical effects, you really do get a feel of what an actual plane crash would be like. Whether that's an accurate picture of it or not, I'm not sure. I'm not up on that kind of stuff, but it is a shocking and awesome, in the most basic sense of the word, piece of filmmaking. And it does work really, really well, even though Cage's acting at the time some of Cage's acting in this one is really good and works really well, but some of it also is Nicolas Cage acting. And so we get a combination of both in that. So that's one of the set pieces that works really, really well. The second set piece that works really, really well is a massive subway car accident where one train crashes into another in a subway, and Cage's character is on one of the trains. And that, even though the CG isn't quite up to modern standards, because you've got to remember this is a movie from 8 years ago, and that field of endeavor is evolving at an ever-changing rate, but it does give us the feeling quite effectively of that train crash and one of the trains mounting the platform, which is crowded with people, and just mowing them down. It doesn't linger on the gore, but it does give us something we're all familiar with on a daily basis in some cases, which is commuting, and turns it into a massive scale horror story. And that again is works really, really well in the movie. Now, I've got a problem with the ending, because we have a little bit of a Deus Ex Machina ending, where the creepy, tall, blonde guys who have been stalking their children are basically rescuing them from the end of the world. And they take only the children and bunny rabbits for some reason, white bunny rabbits, up into their spaceship and take them to another planet which is covered in fields of fat wheat and an enormous silver tree in the distance, which is a parable for the tree of knowledge. And basically all these pairs of children are dumped across the landscape by these crystalline spaceships, which then leave the planet. Now, that for me is a dumb ending. Now, I'll tell you why. For a start, the kids, unless they've got some kind of infrastructure there, the kids are going to starve to death and the rabbits are going to reproduce and eat everything in sight. So what they've done is created Planet of the Rabbits. It's a very pretty ending. I mean, the alien planet is very pretty. But it's an incredibly silly ending as well, because the implications of it, given what we see on the screen, and we can't go beyond what's on the screen in a sense, because then you're making up the story, not the people who make the movie up. So the end story we get is children running across a field of fat, kind of sea anemone-like wheat, towards a big silver tree, while the bunny rabbits are dropped and left on the landscape. So Planet Bunny Rabbit is created. It's a silly ending to the film, and I don't think it does a lot of the questions raised in the rest of the film a hell of a lot of justice. But having said that, I like the fact that they make Australia look like America in some bits. They filmed at Camberwell High School, which has got the right look for an American high school. They filmed some of the movie in the Melbourne CBD, and changed a few road signs and had a few American cars brought in to alter where the steering wheel is. And so they work with that. They have the big long train escalator up at Museum Station, which is an incredibly long and incredibly steep escalator. It's scary. It's almost like standing in a roller coaster ride in some ways. So they have that as part of the movie. And the rest of it was filmed at a Dockland Studios, which is about a kilometre, maybe less than a kilometre from where, for the next week or so, I'm going to be working, because where the place I work for is down at Docklands as well. Dockland Studio is really punching above its weight as far as getting international productions there. And it's not too far from a Costco as well. So if they need anything for set design and set decoration at Dockland Studio, I'm sure they can all go down to Costco and pick up whatever they need. But having said that, I think the movie is visually profound. It really does work. And the end of the world stuff is done quite well in the film. But I think that where it's let down is the rigor of its concept. And having that kind of slightly angelic aliens taking children to a planet of fat wheat, it really does give you that kind of moment of, A lot of people find it very profound. I think people who are believers in some kind of supernatural thing will have less of a problem with the movie than I do. But conceptually, it doesn't work. So these aliens are able to predict the future 50 years ahead of time. And rather than giving the information to somebody, say, like the scientist Richard Feynman, they put it in the brain of a slightly wacky and slightly unusual young girl, who then puts all the information they give her about future events, disasters, not just future events, but future disasters, into a time capsule. I'm not sure what that actually achieves. You're better off to go, okay, here, Richard Feynman, here's a couple of things, one of which is how to make integrated circuits a lot better. What we want to do is gear up your civilization in the next 50 years so some of you can escape, and not just small children and bunny rabbits. So that, for me, that works a lot better. Give people, bootstrap the technology of the human race 50 years ahead of time so they can escape the problems they've got with this enormous solar flare, which the aliens have predicted, along with a whole bunch of lesser disasters. The concept just doesn't make sense to me. It's like, yes, we're going to send you this information about all the bad shit that's going to happen to your people in the next 50 years. And at the end of it, we're just going to grab some children. It really does challenge my acceptance of the genre to have a profoundly stupid concept like that as part of a movie. But again, as I said, visually it really does work. The effects are great. Cage is kind of at 75% of what he's capable of as an actor, which is good. Rose Byrne's character is crazily underwritten, which is very much a shame. Ben Mendelsohn is good in what he does, and some of the supporting actors, including Alan Hopgood playing his father, is kind of cool. And the woman who plays his mother, who doesn't get a word of dialogue, is Benita Colling, who for many, many years was loved by Australian children because she was Benita in Play School. And the generations of children grew up with Benita as the person when they watched Play School. And it was interesting to see her as an older woman playing Nicolas Cage's mum. So I think that Alex Proyas did a fantastic job at directing the movie. I think he's a great visual stylist, and he's got an ambition in what he does in the films that he is a part of, which is kind of rare. And Gods of Egypt, which a lot of people hated, at least created an unusual universe. Yes, there was some whitewashing of some of the characters, and but it was really weird and interesting to see things like Jeffrey Rush playing the sun god, and Brian Brown with a posh accent where he usually has an Australian accent, and just watching things like women riding on giant cobras that spit fire chasing the hero. All of that kind of stuff really does, you know, there's an audacity to it, and there's a visual imagination at work there that I really like. But when Gods of Egypt was criticized so heartily by not only social media but the critics as well, Alex Proyas was mightily pissed off, and he did the thing that was perhaps the least wise thing to do, which was he attacked social media and he attacked people on it rather than kind of putting his ideas together and saying, here's what I was doing, here's what I did, here's why I did it. And you've got to remember, Alex Proyas himself was born in Egypt, so he had a certain right to tell the stories based around that mythology, and obviously it was very much a personal project for him. But he really did savagely attack a lot of people on social media and press conferenced a whole bunch of criticisms at the critics. And in the current environment and in the current infosphere in which we live, that's never going to end well for somebody. It's one of those things where, yep, you can attack people on stuff like that, or you can keep your sense of humor and go, okay, well, I understand that people feel like this, and maybe I misjudge these things, but the story I was trying to tell is this, and explain yourself with equanimity and with a sense of humor and with putting your ego to one side. He could have got through this a lot better than he did, but he made his choices on this, and unfortunately, it hasn't endeared him to the people who in his particular industry he most needs to get on board, which are the fans and the people who review the works that he does. So I wish him well in the future. He's still got years and years and years of career ahead of him, and I hope he uses them well. But there is a lot to admire in the works of Alex Proyas, but I think that there's a certain discipline that needs to be had, particularly with a project like Knowing, where you've got to think your concept through to the end in a way that doesn't look silly. And unfortunately, in this case, it does. But anyway, that's about it this time around. When I next speak to you, I will either be unemployed or retired. I haven't yet decided which. And I'll be spending a lot more time doing interesting things. So thank you for listening. And thank you again to the Patreon supporters, including Best Boy Kerry. And as I've said for about a year now, I really do have to update the Patreon credits for the podcast. And I really apologize for not doing that. My life has been chaotic for the last year and a bit. But I hope that in the very, very near future, it does settle down to a more equanimous kind of environment for me to live in. But again, thanks for listening. I'll be back next week with another Paleo Cinema podcast, in 2 weeks with another Martian Drive-In podcast. And I've got a couple of articles I'm going to be putting out about over the next couple of weeks, which are about half written, but I look forward to finishing them and putting them out there for people to read. So again, here are the credits for the podcast. To acknowledge and thank the Patreon supporters who contribute to the podcast each and every month in the style of movie credits. So look after yourselves. Keep watching the skies. Watch good movies, bad movies, all movies, except things that have Lucasfilms at the front of them, of course. And I'll be back very soon.
Thank you to all of the Patreon subscribers. And here are the credits in the style of movie credits to acknowledge and thank all of them. We have Tom, our focus puller, Sarah, our special effects technician, Ian, our caterer, Grant, our technicolor consultant, Claire, our script doctor, Gary, our prop master, Morris, our music director, Jan, our dialect coach, Armin, our key grip, Matt, our rattlesnake wrangler, Elaine, our scientific advisor, Julia, our casting director, Chris, our camera operator, Christopher, our gaffer, Miss Jane, the wardrobe mistress, Tansy, the foley artist, Alyssa, the location scout, Mark, our second unit director, Paul, our special makeup effects director, Tammy, our donut wrangler, Tim, our New York unit director, Rabbi Steve, our spiritual advisor, Steve, our script doctor, Dylan, our goat wrangler, Eric, our set security lead, Carrie, our second script doctor, Richard, our set photographer, and our extras, Kathleen, Mark, and David. And let's not forget Steve Sullivan, our director of monster effects, and Richard C., our transportation co-captain. So thank you very much to all the subscribers, and you too can subscribe at patreon.com/paleocinema.